During the Cold War, many Americans lived in fear of a nuclear attack from Russia, but in fact, the U.S. was a big threat to itself. Two hydrogen bombs were dropped in Goldsboro by an American plane in an accident in 1961. Thankfully, neither bomb went off, but it turns out this was not an isolated incident. Eric Schlosser's new book is called Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. His book details a long list of nuclear accidents in the 1950s and 60s and beyond. I spoke with him yesterday about what he learned about the Goldsboro nuclear accident in 1961.
Well, it's long been suspected that the plane crash of a B-52 bomber on January 23, 1961, could have led to a nuclear detonation in North Carolina, but there have been conflicting details about it. Former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara had said publicly that 5 of 6 safety switches failed. There was a physicist named Ralph Lapp who wrote a book in which he said much the same thing and said that a 24-megaton bomb could have detonated in North Carolina. And I guess what I've been able to add to the discussion is by interviewing weapons designers who were working on similar weapons at the time, and to get documents through the Freedom of Information Act that pretty conclusively show one of those bombs could have detonated. It was smaller than the physicist Ralph Lapp had suggested. He said it would be 24 megatons. It was actually closer to 4 megatons, but that's an extraordinarily powerful weapon. And there was only one switch that prevented it from detonating. But even in the absence of that switch, when you have a B-52 bomber breaking apart midair that way, there were so many wires crossing that a stray wire could have provided the electricity necessary for the weapon to fully arm and then detonate. So it was a real close call.
It was a real close call. And tell us sort of how serious it could have been had one or both of those bombs gone off.
Well, there was one in particular, and there's quite a famous photograph of it. It looks like it's hanging in a tree, but in actuality, its nose is buried in the ground, and its parachute is draped in a tree. It went through all of the arming steps it was supposed to. As the bomber was breaking up, the centrifugal forces in the bomber pulled a lanyard in the cockpit, and that's the lanyard that would have been pulled by a crew member to drop the bomb over enemy territory. So one bomb, the parachute didn't open, it didn't go through its arming steps, and it vanished into the mud. But the other bomb, parachute opened step by step, batteries charged. When it hit the ground, a firing signal was sent. So it was ready to go. And it's remarkable good fortune that it didn't detonate, because it would have created a huge firestorm in North Carolina. And had the prevailing winds been in the right direction, it could have deposited lethal radioactive fallout over Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and even New York City.
Eric Schlosser's new book is called Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. We will hear more from Eric Schlosser just ahead on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing our conversation recorded yesterday with journalist Eric Schlosser. He's got a new book out, Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. He writes about the 1961 Goldsboro nuclear accident, two hydrogen bombs dropped over North Carolina. Thankfully, neither went off. I asked Eric Schlosser why a B-52 bomber was flying over Goldsboro in the first place.
We were quite worried after Sputnik, after 1957, when the Soviets put up their first satellite. We were worried that they would have intercontinental ballistic missiles that could hit the United States in a surprise attack and wipe out our air bases and wipe out the Strategic Air Command, the part of the Air Force that was in charge of our most powerful nuclear weapons. So the Air Force came up with something called the Airborne Alert, and it was later depicted in films like Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove. We had B-52 bombers in the air 24 hours a day carrying hydrogen bombs ready to strike the Soviet Union. And bombers that were in the air couldn't be destroyed by missiles that hit the ground. So it was a way of keeping part of our Air Force safe from Soviet attack at all times. But it introduced a fair amount of risk. B-52 because it had planes with hydrogen bombs flying over the continental United States, flying over Europe. The record, the safety record, was remarkably good in the sense that there were 30 to 35,000 of these airborne alert missions during the Cold War, and only six probably ended with a plane crash involving nuclear weapons.
And none of them went off.
None of them went off. So that's a very impressive safety record. On the other hand, when it comes to maintaining a nuclear arsenal, one accident is too many. And the consequences of a hydrogen bomb detonating in North Carolina would literally have changed the course of American history.
It is interesting to speculate what might have happened if that, it, in terms of our nuclear future, both in terms of energy and nuclear weapons.
And had the future of the Kennedy administration, because this was just a few days after John F. Kennedy had given that famous inaugural speech.
So was the Goldsboro incident the worst of the nuclear near misses that or near hits that you have uncovered?
It was certainly the most spectacular. But in looking at nuclear accidents, there were instances in which there were much more mundane events that wouldn't and didn't involve a plane crash or a fire or anything like that, that could have led to nuclear detonations. The key thing was to keep the electricity away from the detonators of a nuclear weapon, because that's what would cause a full-scale detonation. There were cases in which there were short circuits in warheads, and someone would be walking by and they would notice smoke coming from the warhead. There were lightning strikes on missiles that were deployed in the field, and it was later realized that lightning could be responsible for detonating a weapon. There were hydrogen bombs and there were atomic bombs that were unloaded improperly from airplanes so that they would be fully armed on the ground when they were unloaded. There's just a litany of near misses, and the book goes through them. The book goes through, I think, and celebrates the technical competence of the engineers who designed our bombs, the great personal heroism of people who flew our planes, who in many cases risked their lives to prevent nuclear catastrophes. But there was also a fair amount of good luck and good fortune, because the switch that prevented that detonation in North Carolina had been found to be defective on at least 30 occasions. It was later removed from bombers because it was considered an inadequate safety device. And as I said earlier, that bomb could have been detonated by a stray wire in the bomber as it broke up, and there were lots of sources of electricity and lots of wires hanging out there as the thing broke apart. So we got away safely that time, but there's no guarantee, so long as there are nuclear weapons, that we won't have one of these accidents again.
Well, and of course, the fact is we still have a nuclear arsenal, and we are not alone in the world in maintaining a nuclear arsenal. Is it just a matter of time before something horrible happens?
I don't think anything is inevitable, and I think we probably designed the safest nuclear weapons in the world. We have more experience with them than anyone. We invented this technology. I'm very concerned about Pakistan and India and Russia, where, you know, their rates of industrial accidents are much higher than ours. But I'm also concerned about the United States. Just this summer, two of our three strategic missile wings were cited for serious safety violations. A few years ago, the Air Force's biggest nuclear storage facility in New Mexico, the whole squadron who managed it was decertified, basically taken off the job for safety violations. So we need to think about these weapons. If we're going to have them, we need to spare no expense in how we maintain them and in the morale of the people who look after them. But these are powerful machines.
Well, and all of this speaks to the handling, safe handling, fail-safe mechanisms that we build in so that they don't go off by accident.
Right.
But there are intentional and mistaken. I mean, we could make a mistake and deliberately fire one of these because we think we're attacked, or the Russians. And that has, we've been perilously close to that kind of deliberate use of nuclear weapons, albeit perhaps mistaken or misguided.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, I go through how difficult it is to manage complex technological systems. And in the case of nuclear weapons, you not only have the warhead or the bomb itself, you have the weapon system it's attached to, whether it's a bomber. In the case of the North Carolina plane, there was a weight imbalance because of fuel that made the bomber break apart. You have a missile. And then, as you say, you have the early warning system, which is going to tell us if we're under attack or not, and give the leadership a very brief brief period of time to decide what to do. And there were a number of occasions during the Cold War in which there were false alarms that led our leaders to believe there was a possibility we might have to attack the Soviet Union.
And even after the Cold War, Boris Yeltsin himself was perhaps 6 minutes or so away from launching an attack.
That's right. And right now, Russia's command and control system and their early warning system is very decrepit and in need of investment. And this makes a very unstable situation. In India and Pakistan, the flight time of a missile is probably 5 or 6 minutes. During the Cold War, a missile launched from the Soviet Union would take about a half hour to reach the United States. If they launched from a submarine, it would be shorter. But our leadership had time to figure out, is this the real thing? Is it a false alarm? And make, you know, the right decision. Whereas with India and Pakistan, there's just minutes, maybe 2 or 3 minutes to decide whether to launch or not. It's a very dangerous situation.
Dangerous and complicated, because if you try to imagine how to climb down, the idea of disarmament, universal, right, disarmament, sounds nearly impossible, because we can't always trust that our partners are going to think the same way, or that somebody else who's not a party to this and not even a nation might not develop a weapon themselves. How do we climb down?
Well, it's going to be a difficult process. It's not going to occur overnight. And I just want to remind your listeners that in the year 1961, when that accident occurred in North Carolina, if you had said someday the Soviet Union will collapse and the Berlin Wall will come down and that'll happen without World War III, without thousands of people being killed, without a nuclear war, people would have thought you were crazy, because 1961 was the year of, you know, another Berlin crisis where we almost went to war. So unlikely good things can happen, but we have to work towards making them happen. And my concern is the enormous complacency about nuclear weapons in the United States right now. We've forgotten that these things are out there. We're not paying attention to them. And these are the most dangerous machines ever built.
Eric, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Schlosser is a journalist. His new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Of course, this is not the first we've heard of the Goldsboro mishap. There was reporting about it at the time, though the government lied about the details, and there is a book about the incident. It's called The Goldsboro Broken Arrow, and author Joel Dobson joins us now. Welcome, Joel. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Jack Revelle, the commander of the team that located the bombs. He's now a consulting statistician for his own company, Revelle Solutions, and he is with us. Hello, Jack.
Good morning.
And Adam Maddox was the third pilot on that B-52 bomber that disintegrated in midair over Goldsboro. He is one of the survivors of the crash, and he is with us as well. Adam Maddox, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Joel Dobson, let me start with you and talk about the accident itself. What happened in that 1961 mission?
Well, basically, this airplane, this B-52 that was taking off at about 11 o'clock that morning, was getting ready for the airborne alert that was mentioned earlier. Airborne alert had just started a few days before, and this crew, this seven-man crew, was being checked out. It was called a cover-all mission, in which to cover all aspects of the airborne alert mission. That day they had seven on the B-52 and one ride along. So these eight men were in this airplane that was going to fly for 24 hours, and they simulated in all aspects an actual mission. They had two weapons aboard, two Mark 39 weapons that were rated at 3.8 megatons. These were a sealed pit weapon, which means they did not have a canister to insert inside the airplane. Once that one switch that Jeff was talking about, the arm safe switch, was put on arm and the weapons were dispensed, they would go through a process where they could detonate upon impact. Now, the airplane had gone through one mid-air refueling mission already, and about halfway through the mission, they were in their second refueling, and they had a huge fuel loss. They lost 19 tons of fuel in the first 2 minutes. They went out beyond Wilmington. They flew around at sea for several hours. trying to figure out what to do. The wing commander told him to come on back to Seymour Johnson. They had taken off for Seymour Johnson in Goldsboro, and they were going to land at Seymour Johnson. And they were about 15 miles out and about 10,000 feet and flying straight and level. And all of a sudden, the airplane started on its own to turn to the right, and it increased its turn to the right until the right wing actually folded up and broke off the airplane. And, of course, everything went real bad real fast. Adam Maddox was the decided to jump out the hatch, one of the pilot's hatch. And he was the only man that ever survived that type of bailout. He did not have an ejection seat. The reason why most people don't survive, they are normally hit by the tail and killed instantly. The reason he wasn't hit by the tail had just broken off.
Well, this plane is disintegrating on its way to Seymour Johnson, which is the Air Force Base in Goldsboro, with weapons that are 250 times the amount of explosive that dropped on Hiroshima. So, Adam, you did not have an ejection seat. Tell us about that. When did you first notice? What were you doing when you first saw this plane was about to break up?
When I saw the first thing, I really didn't see much breakup. What I saw was that the plane was in a right turn, and the commanding officer and the co-pilot could not get it out of the right turn. I guess it lost part of the wing or something there, but I wasn't sure.
So you jumped, and you made it safely, and as Joel said, an unlikely landing, safe landing for you, given the fact that the way you went, you didn't have an ejection seat. So you went out the hard way. What were you thinking at the time? I'm trying to imagine. I mean, on the one hand, this is a plane that's disintegrating. That's dangerous enough. And you're sitting on two, you know, hydrogen bombs. What were the thoughts going through your mind as you left that plane?
Well, the thoughts I had was that I had to get out of the plane and make sure that I didn't get hit on the way out. And I jumped for the co-pilot's hatch first because he had ejected. And by that time, the aircraft commander looked around at me. I was still pinned to the floor. Looked around at me as if to say, I'm going to eject. So he pulled his hand up on the seat and he got ejected out. And then I said to myself, I got two ways out. I can't walk down the stairs fast enough to get out, and I can jump for this hatch on the right side, which was the co-pilot side, or follow the aircraft commander out of his hatch, jump on that side. But with the plane spinning, because we were in the right turn all the time, then it starts spinning, I figured that if I jumped from where I was on the floor, pinned to the floor, to the co-pilot's hatch, I will miss his hatch. So I decided to jump towards that, but make the turn and go out the aircraft commander's hatch. So that's what I did. When I caught the side of the hatch and started to pull myself out, I got either pulled out, shot out, or something like that. But I was suspended in space when I went out. There was no movement up nor down.
Wow, that's amazing presence of mind with all that going on. When you finally reached the ground safely, what was the first thing you did?
First thing I did was to pick up all the government equipment, the parachute and everything else, and I had landed about 25 feet from a lady's house. Landing in the field that he had just plowed that day. And I stepped up on the porch, and this porch was between the kitchen and the regular basic house. There were two of the young boys and a lady that lived in the house were watching and heard the explosions. And I told them, don't, you know, I'm not from Mars, because I had to pull my hat back over my head, and I had the parachute around under my arm. And so they looked around and was shocked, but then was all right. And I asked them, where was the mother and father, or father? They said, over there in the other part of the building. So I walked down that walkway to there and asked her to have one of her sons to take me to the base so I could get there and notify anybody that, you know, that were not aware at the time.
And something bad happened. Well, Adam, you did make that report. Others did as well. And, Jack, that's when you're called to the scene. What was it like to get that call?
Well, considering the fact that I'd been on a previous broken arrow just 6 months before, it didn't surprise me. It was just so early in the morning that when my squadron commander called me and said, Jack, I've got a real one for you, instead of using the expected code words and numbers that we had trained for, I knew there was something really bad happening. And so as soon as I was awake, I got my flight suit on and my pre-packed bag and drove down to the flight line at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where my detachment and I were assigned, and got on the jet aircraft. It was a T-33, which is the training equivalent of an F-80 Shooting Star. And we took off for Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Broken Arrow, of course, the term for a kind of a warhead, a nuclear weapon accident, right?
Accident or a damaged nuclear weapon, a lost nuclear weapon, anything that's bad that may have happened to a nuclear warhead, whether it's on a missile or a bomber or in storage.
When you are going to a site like that, what are you thinking? Obviously, they haven't gone off, but are you going there expecting they might go off any minute?
I'm expecting the worst. You know, that you have to plan for the worst and hope for the best.
All right. Well, we will continue this conversation. I'm up against a time post here, but we're going to come back. Jack Revelle, who led the team that disarmed the Goldsboro nuclear bombs, he's now a consulting statistician for Revelle Solutions. Joel Dobson is the author of The Goldsboro Broken Arrow. It's a book. Adam Maddox is one of the survivors of that airplane crash that brought down those two bombs, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We've been talking about a couple of H-bombs that rained down on Goldsboro in 1961. Yeah, you can chuckle now. It ended up okay. Joel Dobson is the author of The Goldsboro Broken Arrow that details that story. Jack Revelle led the team that disarmed the Goldsboro nuclear bombs. He's now a consulting statistician for Revelle Solutions. Adam Maddox was the third pilot on that plane that broke apart over Goldsboro, one of five survivors. Three crew members were killed. So Jack, tell us what that site looked like when you got there.
It was a mess. It looked like another world war had taken place. There was scattered aircraft all around, hundreds of people, including many, many air police personnel, you know, to cordon off the area, to keep looky-loos from getting in to see what was going on. And so when I was driven by Jeep from where we landed at the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base flight line out to the site of the accident, which took about 30 minutes, I was brought directly up to the site of the first bomb, what we're calling the first bomb. That's the one that looked like the Washington Monument, just standing there in the middle of the field under some trees. As was said earlier, the nose had protruded into the ground, and the shrouds of the parachute were hanging in the tree. And the sergeant that drove me up in the Jeep pointed out where it was, and not too far, maybe 100 yards or so from the main road. And he says, well, what do you think? And I looked at him. I said, it's a bomb. What do you think it is?
It's not a bomb. It is the bomb. But okay. So by the way, there's a photo on our website if you want to see this, dataofthings.org. But go ahead.
Well, we got up there, and there was already some local personnel that were standing around. And they said, well, what do we need to do? I said, well, all the critical components are on the alignment plate, which is directly in front of the parachute pack, which is, at the tail end of the bomb. And so he says, well, how do we get it off? I said, can you get a crane here? And so they got a crane, and it lifted parachute pack off of this bomb that was standing there in the field. And there is a picture in Joel Dobson's book, The Goldsboro Broken Arrow, not of that bomb, but of the second bomb, where the parachute pack is being lifted by a crane out of the hole off of the second bomb. I'll tell you more about that later. But we lifted the parachute pack off of the bomb, and that exposed the alignment plate. And now we could see the arm safe switch. We could see the zipper, which is a high-speed neutron generator, the battery pack, and a variety of other critical components that are all associated with the preparing the weapon to go full-scale detonation.
Well, let me ask you right there. I do have to ask you, because it's my understanding that everything was ready to go except for one switch. Is that right? And that's the one on which, because the parachute deployed on one, that's the one hanging in the tree. The parachute didn't. That's the one deep in a hole. You're looking at the one that's hanging from a tree where the parachute deployed. And apparently that one was all ready to go but for one switch. Am I right about that?
Well, at the time, we didn't know. You know, this is like cold case. We're standing there in the middle of a tobacco field in the middle of winter with ice and snow and rain and water all around us. And all we can do is look at this thing and see, does it look like it's been tampered with? Does it look like it's been activated? Is it safe? Is it unarmed? So far as we could tell at that moment, you know, it's easy enough for guys like the author of Command and Control and others to, after the fact, decide what was good and what was bad. But we who were there at the time, all we knew is it looked to be in a safe condition to deactivate the weapon. And so what we did, once we determined that it was in a condition where it was movable, was to use that same crane to drop the that weapon that was in a vertical position standing there down into a horizontal position and lift it very carefully, of course, onto a flatbed truck, where it was driven back to the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base and then ultimately shipped back to Medina Base in Texas, where the thing had been assembled in the first place.
That second bomb, harder to find, right? That's in a hole.
That was in a hole, but nobody had seen it yet. after we finished about a half a day on that first bomb, they said, oh, there's this second weapon, and we have to go find it. And they found a place maybe a half a mile away, where there was a hole in the ground. They weren't sure if that hole was from the bomb or from something else, you know, a big woodchuck. And so I said, get me a long broomstick, you know, something really long, and it had to be wooden because it had to be non-sparking.
Right.
Because if you touch that weapon
right.
with something metallic, you could have sparking, and that could cause some kind of problem with the weapon. Well, they found me a really long stick, and we pushed that down into the hole and found something solid subsurface. So I said, okay, we've got to assume that this is where the second weapon penetrated the ground. And by the way, they figured out afterwards that it hit the ground at about the speed of sound, Mach 1, about 700 miles per hour. And it penetrated the ground and went down on an angle down to we got my team of 10, the Terrible 10, and I got down to about 50 feet or so. And we were pulling all kinds of parts out, the 92 detonators, all of the explosive that surrounded the uranium and plutonium core of the primary, which is the atomic bomb portion of this thermonuclear weapon. And we kept digging on it and digging on it. And so, you know, we realized, you know, obviously we were in the right place. But after 8 days of digging, we had found everything except what's called the secondary. Now, the secondary is that portion of a thermonuclear weapon, and it's located near the nose, the front end of the bomb. We couldn't find it. So what we assumed, based on what we had already found, was just like in an automobile, you know, if you don't have your seatbelt on and you put the brakes on real hard, you're going to go right through the windshield if you're driving real fast. Well, that's what happened with the secondary. It went right through the nose of the weapon, which was slowing down because of the density of the earth that it was plowing through at down 50 feet below the surface, and it just kept going down and down and down. So after 8 days, they said, look, you guys have done your work. You've got the thing in a condition where others can take it over. So we packed up and went back to Wright-Patterson to prepare for the next broken arrow.
Well, and the secondary, we should point out, the secondary is the part that holds the plutonium.
Yes.
Yes.
But it requires... there's no high explosive in it.
It's radioactive, and we can't find it.
But it's completely sealed.
Right.
And as a result, with the plutonium and the uranium in there, and plus a tampering, a covering over it, that the likelihood of any kind of radiological exposure is like slim to none. And in fact, the government on an annual basis checks for radioactivity in the water and the land in and around that point of entry of the second weapon, and no evidence after over 50 years of any kind of nuclear exposure has been found.
Joel, how much did we know at the time, and how did the information get out to people at Goldsboro at the time?
At the time, the Air Force said four things. They said there were two bombs. They had both been located. They were unarmed, and there was absolutely no danger. Actually, only one of those things was true. There were two bombs. All the other things were not true.
Not quite true. So it's taken a while. Adam Maddox, I want to ask one last question here, and I want to put it to you. At what point through this whole ordeal were you thinking, oh, I'm not out of the woods yet. There's two H-bombs in the area. Were you thinking about the possibility, even after you landed, that those things just might go off?
Yes, but I didn't know that much about the unit itself. But, yeah, you think about all of that as you feel that, hey, I got out okay and I'm living, but if that go off, that'll be the end of it.
It could be the end of it. Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Adam Maddox, third pilot on the plane that broke apart over Goldsboro, one of five survivors in that wreck. Three crew members died. Jack Revelle led the team that disarmed those nuclear bombs. He's now a consulting statistician for Revelle Solutions. Joel Dobson, author of the book Goldsboro, Broken Arrow. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.